Good morning. Welcome to this today's first session. And we are beginning with Dr. Marie Hoffman. She is an adjunct clinical assistant professor of psychology from New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. Co-director, Society for Exploration of Psychoanalytic Therapies and Theology. Director of the Brookhaven Institute for Psychoanalysis and Christian Theology. Co-director, Psychoanalyst and Clinical Psychologist of Brookhaven Center, Allentown, Pennsylvania, and author of Towards Mutual Recognition. Dr. Hoffman will have 20 minutes to present and 5 minutes for discussion. And the lecture is Fairbairn and Religion.
Fairbairn's choice of a vocation in psychoanalysis has often been understood as a deviation from his earlier religious predilections. I believe it was its fulfillment. Fairbairn, unlike the psychoanalytic world in which he lived, recognized no split between faith and science. His faith informed his vocation. The Judaic and Christian narratives portray a pristine personal beginning. A shattering decline, and hope of redemption through healing love is the cadence that permeates Fairbairn's life work. Religious influences in the life of W.R.D. Fairbairn. Christianity took root in Britannia by 200 CE and developed into a genre of Christianity that interwove church and academy. While the French Enlightenment generated philosophes that revolted against all that was religious, the, quote, enlightenment in Britain took place within rather than against Protestantism, unquote, a factor that would shape the interdisciplinary thinking of Ronald Fairbairn. W.R.D. Fairbairn was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, in 1889, only child to Thomas and Cecilia Fairbairn. Thomas's family left the Church of Scotland during what became known as the 1843 Disruption and were founding members of the Free Church of Scotland. According to Sutherland, Ronald attended the Free Church each Sunday morning and evening with his parents. The church's ethos was conservative evangelicalism, producing a rigidity and joylessness that ultimately influenced Fairbairn's decision at midlife to convert to the Anglican Church. Fairbairn was educated at Merkeston Castle School. Charles Chalmers, of the Free Church of Scotland, founded this prep school. Charles' brother, scientist and theologian, Thomas, founded the Free Church of Scotland. The brothers Chalmers' respect for science and faith fully informed Merkeston's curriculum. According to Scharf and Bertels, the, quote, metaphysical content of Fairbairn's first degree at Edinburgh University was strongly influenced by the interests of Professor Andrew Seth Pringle-Pattison in the philosophies of Kant and Hegel. Pringle-Pattison was deeply interested in issues of faith and emphasized, quote, communion as the essence of religion, unquote. His 1912 Gifford lectures were entitled The Idea of God in the Light of Recent Philosophy. His final lecture addressing the central Christian concept of redemption by atoning love. Between 1912 and 1914, Fairbairn studied theology at the universities of Kiel, Strasbourg, and Manchester. These studies included Hellenistic Greek, also called Koine or Biblical Greek, a mainstay of formal theological studies. Fairbairn confirms this in his autobiographical note, quote, the result was that I devoted the next 3 years to the study of divinity and Hellenistic Greek, unquote. Fairbairn's divinity studies were interrupted by his World War I military service after which he transferred his passion to help people from pastoral ministry to psychotherapy. He embarked on medical studies and in 1921 began an analysis with Ernest Connell, who had been analyzed by Ernest Jones. Connell's depiction by Sutherland as a, quote-unquote, full-blooded Christian, likely has roots in his youthful affiliation with a conservative evangelical church in Australia. Fairbairn's library included Ian Suttie's Origins of Love and Hate, with almost every chapter heavily annotated. Linking his psychoanalytic thinking with his religious narrative, Suttie asserted that Christianity, quotes, offers the conception of social life as based upon love rather than upon the authority, and believed, quote, the main concern of Christian teachings to be the cultivation of love as the basis of happiness, mental stability, and social harmony, unquote. Let me just take a moment and interject here that one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that many of the people that were attracted to psychoanalysis were privately Christians because the Judaic narrative spoke to them that was subtextual in psychoanalysis, the method of interpretation, the rabbinical tradition, and the desire for redemption to the nations was there, and it drew them. We think of Rickman, we think of Hatfield, Suttie. All of these were at Tavistock, which was also, in a more familiar way, known as the Parsons Clinic. While there is no known reference to philosopher John McMurray by Fairbairn, quote, we know from his daughter Eleanor Fairbairn Birrell's personal communication that the men knew each other and may have collaborated, unquote. McMurray's emphasis on the personal pervades Fairbairn's thinking, and McMurray articulated a theistic origin of personal relations. Quote, philosophically, a belief in God is necessary, since the character of the world's unity can only be personal. Only an absolute personality can be the ground of the existence of finite persons, unquote. Religious evidences in the life of W.R.D. Fairbairn. Fairbairn's personal diaries reveal his voluntary leadership at age 29 to 30 of combined chapel meetings called the Braids Schoolboys Meetings for five preparatory academies. His diaries from 1917 through 1963 also document his regular participation in Christian community, even in North Africa during the war. His entries for 1919 list 51 dates of church attendance. In midlife, his church attendance became less regular as he participated in psychoanalytic conferences and scheduled appointments 7 days a week to care for war veterans. In 1963, at the end of his life, Fairbairn records 13 entries of church attendance. It was absolutely fascinating to go to the archives and look through his diaries, which are so well documented. And he lists who he had lunch with after church, who he went to supper with, and church service in the middle of the week. So at least toward the beginning of his life, he was constantly going to church. That decreased, and I think that there became a balance in which no longer was there quite the passion for the church per se, but he saw the ethos of healing coming through psychotherapy, and he integrated that. Confirming the centrality of his faith in Fairbairn's 21st birthday diary entry, he writes, true Christianity ought to satisfy every legitimate instinct and aspiration. God, give me strength to do my share, however little, to effect that unspeakably desired consummation. I have decided to devote my life to the cause of religion, but may it be a healthy, wholehearted, strong religion, appealing to the enthusiasm of youth, as well as to the quiescence of old age. In other words, may it be a Christ-like religion. He had seen hypocrisy. He had seen what fell short. And he wanted to be a factor, an agent, through the contributions that psychoanalysis could bring, to help bring about greater truth and honesty and aliveness in the Christian setting that he was in. I assert that Fairbairn's use of religious references in his writings reflected his lifespan embrace of the Christian narrative, not merely an adaptation to his Scottish culture. In more than 20 significant professional papers written over 35 years beginning in 1927, Fairbairn integrated his Christian faith with his psychoanalytic thinking. He recognized the potential of psychoanalytic perspectives to enhance, refine, and clarify his Christian worldview. In one representative statement in Religion and Psychotherapy in 1958, Fairbairn opines, "From a religious, or at any rate a Christian point of view, what man seeks salvation from is sin, estrangement from God, spiritual death, and that fear which is cast out by perfect love. Correspondingly, from a psychotherapeutic point of view, what, in my opinion, the patient seeks salvation from would appear to be something very much like the forgiveness of sins and the casting out of devils." Religious themes in the work of W.R.D. Fairbairn. The Calvinistic themes of creation, fall, and redemption abundantly emerge in Fairbairn's conceptualizations of parent-infant and psychotherapeutic relationships. And I just want to mention, I can only in this short presentation give a brief view of what we're talking about when we're talking about the Calvinistic themes. There tends to be a very stereotyped view of what Calvinism is about, and I suggest that if you have any interest in what I'm saying, my book, which goes into it a lot more thoroughly, would explain that. It's worth understanding, particularly if you're dealing with people that come from that particular mindset. I will explicate parallel conceptions of the cadence of creation, fall, and redemption in both Fairbairn's work and Calvinist theology. Radically departing from Freud's drive theory, Fairbairn envisioned the infant as born with an innate inclination to seek the parent not simply for survival, but for relationship. Stephen Mitchell, acknowledging the dawn of a new psychoanalytic era, comments, "Fairbairn was suggesting that object-seeking in its most radical form is not the vehicle for satisfaction of a specific need, but the expression of our very nature, the form through which we become specifically human beings." Calvin's religious anthropology commences with humans hardwired to desire relationship with their creator. Calvin asserted, "Every human being is formed to be a spectator of the created world and given eyes to be led to its author by contemplating so beautiful a representation." Lane extrapolates, "Calvin knew that human desire for relationship at its best is but a mirror of God's own desire for relationship." Neil Skolnick writes, "For Fairbairn, the establishment of the endopsychic structure, while universal and inevitable, represents a fall from grace. In keeping with his Calvinistic narrative, Fairbairn's psyche is structuralized through fragmentation. Contrasted with most developmental theories explicating psychic growth, quote, Fairbairn maintained that structural differentiation is a defensive and pathological process in human development. For Calvin, a pristine humanity marked by internal and external harmony within the self and with others devolves into a fallen and fractured world. This cataclysmic event structured a world separated from God and others and marked by the absence of sympathy or affinity that formerly aided understanding and the loss of harmony within ourselves in the plurality of conflicting motives and emotions." Fairbairn theorized an internal world bereft of good objects. He poignantly portrayed the infant accommodating its good longings to relate by succumbing to corrupting, exciting, and rejecting interactions with its caretakers. Calvin's Christian narrative depicts an out-of-reach post-fall God. God is replaced by exciting and rejecting insufficient substitutes. Jonathan Edwards, an American Calvinist, explained, "Before, the human soul was under the government of that noble principle of divine love, whereby it was enlarged to the comprehension of all his fellow creatures and their welfare. But so soon as he had transgressed against God, these noble principles were immediately lost, and he became totally governed by narrow and selfish principles and feelings." For Fairbairn, humans become not only separated from the good, they are attracted to the bad. His formulation of cathexis to bad objects reinterpreted the compulsion to repeat as one's only option to remain connected to parental objects. Extending this, Fairbairn deciphered the transgenerational transmission of attachment to bad objects in his paper, The Repression and the return of bad objects. Calvin's bondage to sin was a familiar theme in sermons of Fairbairn's youth. An often sung hymn of the Free Church proclaims, "Thy power alone, O Son of God, can this sore bondage break." For Calvin, bondage to sin was the iniquity of the fathers being visited on the children to the third and fourth generation, found in Exodus 25, an inescapable transgenerational transmission of the bad. Fairbairn's theory depicts a ubiquitous human condition of bad objects locked into a mausoleum of projected internal drama that obstruct recognition of and connection with another as truly other. Concluding his essay on schizoid factors in the personality, Fairbairn summarized this condition through use of religious metaphor. Quote, "Since the joy of loving seems hopelessly barred to him, he may as well deliver himself over to the joy of hating and obtain what satisfaction he can out of that. He thus makes a pact with the devil and says, 'Evil, be thou my good.'" Unquote. For Fairbairn, the end point of humanity's fall from grace is the devastation of relationship. Calvin asserted that the consequence of internalized badness is alienation from God, that becomes de facto alienation from one's neighbors. Jonathan Edwards recapitulates Calvin. "Each person shrank, as it were, into a little space, circumscribed and closely shut up within itself, to the exclusion of all things else. Sin, like some powerful astringent, contracted his soul to the very small dimensions of selfishness, and God was forsaken, and fellow creatures forsaken, and man retired within himself." Fairbairn understood the analyst's tasks as finding an entree into the closed internal world of the patient to offer opportunity for a redemptive relationship with a real other. His ultimate objective in this new relationship was reintegration of split-off aspects of self. Fairbairn variously characterized the analyst's function as messiah, savior, exorcist, and evangelist. The patient comes to experience the analyst as a new good object, hopes for the possibility of something better, and in Fairbairn's words, may be induced to relinquish the bad and attach to the good. More than a century before Fairbairn's contributions, the Calvinist founder of the Free Church of Scotland, Thomas Chalmers, presaged Fairbairn's formulations in a legendary sermon entitled "The Expulsive Power of a New Affection." I will replace Chalmers' use of the word "world" with Fairbairn's term "bad object." This is quoting from the sermon. "The love of the bad object cannot be expunged by a mere demonstration of the bad object's worthlessness. But may it not be supplanted by the love of that which is more worthy than itself? The heart cannot be prevailed upon to part with the bad object by a simple act of resignation. But may not the heart be prevailed upon to admit into its preference another who shall subordinate the bad object and bring it down from its wonted ascendancy? It is not by exposing the worthlessness of the former, but by addressing to the mental eye the worth and excellence of the latter, that all old things are to be done away, and all things are to become new. In fullest accordance with the mechanism of the heart, a great moral revolution may be made to take place upon it." Chalmers asserted that if the internal world of badness can be breached by one who will not perpetrate further fracture, but who instead will offer a healing relationship, attachment to the bad can be surrendered. The previously bound person is freed to respond to a love in external reality. Conclusion. Fairbairn's psychoanalytic vision, built upon his abiding belief in a relational cosmos, guided the revolutionary relational shift that has reconfigured psychoanalysis. His Judeo-Christian narrative transmuted contemporary psychoanalytic theory. Correspondingly, his psychoanalytic theory reaffirmed and suffused his sacred narrative. Together, they surpass what each once was and flourish as a tree of life for humanity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman. Okay, we have 5 minutes for questions and comments. Can you please say your name?
Thank you. Liz Bondi from the University of Edinburgh. Hi. I loved your paper. Thank you very much indeed. And now you know who I am. You will guess my question, which is to ask you to say a little bit more about the particular influence of not only Fairbairn's Scottish context, but the fact that so many of these other influences are embedded in a Scottish culture, a Scottish religious tradition, which is so different from that Britishness to which he referred.
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
I was impacted by the fact that all of Great Britain grabbed onto this object relations personal approach in contrast to a more, hydraulic view of drives and instincts. And I think that was because the academy and faith were not separate in Great Britain. I do believe, and I'm not, I can speak about Scotland, but I believe that in Scotland in particular, the tremendous intellectual motherlode there that held it all together was particularly salient, and I wish that you would speak to that more.
Judith Field. University of Edinburgh. I suppose I was wanting you to sort of follow on a little from what Liz was actually talking about, because it seemed to me the very fact that Fairbairn actually lived in Scotland, in Edinburgh, far away from the centre of psychoanalysis in London, far away from the Jewish refugees, and actually that gave him the freedom, but also the isolation to create his thinking in the context of a Scottish tradition. Because I think what I also want to say is that the Calvinist tradition in Scotland is actually very different from the Calvinist tradition in Switzerland, in Germany, and also in England. And it's that specificity that actually influences him. But I also think it's one of the reasons why he was so neglected.
We think of ideas even in terms of a system. You have on the one hand Fairbairn, who is a Calvinist and infusing his theory with that. On the other hand, you have Winnicott, who was Wesleyan, and who totally got rid of the idea of the fall, the death instinct, really rebelled against Klein's ideas. But you really have two poles of Christian theology. You have the Calvinist and the Arminian coming out and getting infused into psychoanalytic theory.
We have only 1 minute.
I want to ask two things. One, you know, it's very short notice. It's the links of Fairbairn as an attachment theory with John Bowlby, born here. But also I'm Scottish, and I'm afraid I was brought up with original sin. And where is original sin? We were born bad.
Well, you know, I don't know that Fairbairn ever found a pristine ego. I don't know what you want to do with that. I think we all become broken, whatever you want to call it. We can't escape into the world perfectly. And it's that brokenness of our fallenness in human nature, our thrownness, as Heidegger would say.
Thank you very much for such an interesting presentation, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you. That was very interesting.
Okay, respecting our time boundaries, we will continue with Dr. James Bolton, and he will be presenting Philosophical Foundations of Fairbairn. Dr. Poulton is a PhD psychologist in private practice in Salt Lake City, adjunct professor in psychology, University of Utah, faculty, International Psychotherapy Institute, Washington, D.C., author of Object Relations and Relationality in Couple Therapy. Dr. Jim Poulton will also have 20 minutes, and we'll have 5 minutes for questions. Thank you.
Morning. Can you all hear me?
Okay. Put your microphone a little higher up.
A little higher up. Okay. Today.
No. Yeah.
There we go. Is that pointer?
Yes.
Okay. Today, I want to talk about the philosophical background of Fairbairn's approach to psychoanalysis. I'd like to do so, actually, not so much by reviewing Fairbairn's philosophical orientation in general, but by focusing on the idea of a specific issue, dualism, and the development of Fairbairn's strong and actually quite sophisticated arguments against it, in order to illustrate why the question of dualism was of such interest to Fairbairn. I'll focus on his response to the specific form of dualism found in Freud's theory of instincts. That is, in Freud's decision to separate psychic structure from mental energy. The dualism inherent in Freud's views, I will suggest, has a long history in philosophic theory. It goes back, in fact, all the way to Plato, who asserted that the essences of things exist in a plane, a Platonic heaven, different than the actual things themselves. And it can also be traced, as Dr. Hoffman has helped us to see, through the Judeo-Christian traditions of the separation of the soul from the physical body. Perhaps, though, it is to dualism's most famous proponent, René Descartes, the philosopher whose separation of mind from body had, since the Enlightenment, the most lasting influence over the philosophic and scientific atmosphere of Europe, to whom the genealogy of Freud's theories can be most directly traced. In this presentation, I would like to accomplish three things. First, I want to show Freud's debt to Descartes in the formulation of the basic assumptions of Freud's theory. Second, I want to show how Fairbairn's criticisms of dualistic theories, particularly those of Freud, were grounded in his understanding both of their psychoanalytic implications as well as their place in the history of philosophy. And third, I want to briefly describe Fairbairn's alternative theory, a theory that refused dualism in favor of a unitary, integrated, and dynamic self. Okay, now in order to do this, I'm going to have to spend a little time with Descartes. So bear with me. I've got pictures to illustrate what Descartes was talking about. Okay? There we go. Okay. In 1649, so some time ago, Descartes published a book entitled The Passions of the Soul, in which he outlined his theory of psychology with special emphasis on emotion. Unsurprisingly, Descartes grounded his psychology on mind-body dualism, which implied not only the separation of mental substance, in other words, mind, from physical substance, the body, but also that each substance exhibited radically different properties. Physical substance exists in space and time, and it is subject to all laws of causality. Mental substance, being made of the same stuff as God, in Descartes' theory, was immaterial, free, and rational. Having separated mind from body, however, Descartes faced the same difficulty that plagues all dualistic systems, explaining how mind and body, once you separate them, come together again to interact. Descartes solved this problem, or at least he hoped he solved this problem, by turning to the primitive physiology of his day. Now follow me here, because I find this absolutely fascinating. Mind and body, Descartes suggested, communicate with each other. Now remember, immaterial mind and physical body communicate with each other at a specific site in the brain, the pineal gland. Okay? The pineal body, as Descartes called it. This was the site where the nerves, which he conceived of as hollow little tubes, brought the communicating agents from the body, which he called the animal spirits, to the mind. Animal spirits, for Descartes, were like air or wind, whose oscillations reflected the physical events of the body. When they arrived at the pineal gland, they moved it. He even used the word, they ring the gland, okay? They move the gland in such a way that the mind was given the perception of those events. So in this diagram, which is from Descartes, one of Descartes' books, the perception of the arrow brings light to the eyes. The eyes take that sensation, and the animal spirits reflect that in their oscillations. They take it in further into the brain to the pineal body. The pineal body translates the animal spirits into a perception for the soul, okay? And then the soul, if it decides to take an action, like to make the arm move to point, right? The soul has a thought. It gives it to the pineal body, which translates it to the animal spirits, which then course down the nerves in the arm and cause the arm to move, okay? All right. So in Descartes' view, the mind's sole function, vis-a-vis its relationship with the body, lay in its capacity for perception and thought. When the mind receives messages from the body, it merely registers them as perceptions on its internal ideational screen. Remember, the mind is immaterial. And when the mind sends messages to the body, as in through the arms, it merely has a thought, which, having no causal power of its own, only leads to real-world consequences once it is translated into the actions of the animal spirits through the mediation of the pineal gland. Even though the Cartesian mind, then, was free and rational in its own realm, in its relationship with the body, and all of the body's emotions and desires and activities and drives, it was passive and disconnected enough that it played no direct role in determining the events of the body. It's for this reason that the Cartesian mind has been called an homunculus. Okay? This little guy right there. I love this, this cartoon. The homunculus is something like a little person occupying an immaterial space inside the physical spaces of the body, removed, serene, and deliberate, but also imprisoned by its passivity in regard to its physical surroundings. Okay? Now, I would hope that all of you are quite impressed by the contortions that Descartes forced himself through in order to explain the communication between mind and body. These contortions actually did not go unnoticed in the history of philosophy. Only 38 years after Descartes published his theory, Walter von Schirnhaus, a German philosopher and scientist, also the confidant of Spinoza — if any of you know, Spinoza was very anti-Cartesian. He was the confidant of Spinoza and the inventor of porcelain. I thought this was a very Renaissance guy, okay? Walter von Schirnhaus published a book called Medicina Mentis, in which he took Descartes to task for the labyrinthine convolutions in his explanations of ordinary human experience. To von Schirnhaus, the obfuscation in Descartes' theory was due in large measure to his reliance on dualism, under the burden of which the theory had become so entangled and so abstract that it rendered its subject, the emotions, almost completely unrecognizable. To correct what he saw as a disastrous trend, von Schirnhaus proposed that any definition of an emotion should cause the reader to not just understand a theory of emotion, but to feel that emotion. The definition of sadness, he said, should make you sad. And when you read a theory of humor, you should be laughing. Isn't that great? The readers of von Scherenhaus's day probably found his proposal as droll, as do modern readers. Still, there is something wise and appealing in his critique of Cartesianism and in his warning that if we stray too far when constructing psychological theories from life as it is actually lived, then we leave our subject too far behind and lose track of what it was we were hoping to explain. Today, von Scherenhaus is a forgotten figure in the history of philosophy, but his arguments live on. They were revived, in fact, most likely unwittingly, by Fairbairn in his critique of Freud's instinct theory when he said that the psychologist should, quote, classify instincts according to the nature of the experiences which they afford, quite apart from the biological ends which are served. In order to describe the full meaning of this criticism that Fairbairn advanced about Freud, I want to now turn to Freud's theory. The central assumption upon which Freud constructed his theory was of a radical separation between mental energy and psychic structure. By mental energy, Freud meant the energy supplied by the instincts, which he saw as the sole source of energy for the entire organism. And by psychic structure, he meant the id, ego, and superego, those systems of the mind that generate the desires, fantasies, and emotions that make up the bulk of meaningful lived experiences. Following the basic outlines of dualism, Freud believed that these two elements, energy and structure, exhibited very different, radically different characteristics. In contrast to psychic structures, instincts were not psychological at all. This is a point Fairbairn really emphasizes. Instincts were not psychological at all, but purely biological, their energy originating solely in a state of excitation in the body. Instincts do not aim, moreover, toward the kinds of objects, such as mothers or fathers, that are of interest to our psychic structures. Instead, they follow the pleasure principle only, and they aim only toward reducing the tension they themselves introduce into the psychic system. Psychic structures, on the other hand, were given no energy of their own, under Freud's theory. Any apparent energy they possessed, they borrowed from the instincts themselves. This implied, as Freud frequently observed, that psychic structures, particularly the ego, were passive, weak, and primarily receptive, even perceptive, in their relationships with the instincts. We have already concluded, Freud said in Ego and the Id, that the ego is especially under the influence of perception, and that perceptions may be said to have the same significance for the ego as instincts have for the id. Freud drove home the powerlessness and weakness of the ego and its limited and limiting perceptual functions with two analogies. First, he compared it to, quote, a man on horseback who has to hold in check the superior strength of the horse, with this difference that the rider tries to do so with his own strength, while the ego uses borrowed forces. It's important to note that Freud never actually explained how the ego borrows instinctual energy, which I, as I was reading through Freud, I was thinking that's quite a gap, and a gap that I think Fairbairn might have been concerned about. Second, Freud compared the ego to the cortical homunculus of the anatomists, and described it as an entity that merely registers the events of the body on its surface. In fact, for Freud, the ego is even less substantial than that. It is, quote, not merely a surface energy entity, he said, but is itself the projection of a surface. Freud's introduction of the image of an homunculus should, of course, remind us of Descartes, and for good reason, since the parallels between Freud and Descartes are extensive. First, in a manner very similar to Descartes, Freud had placed into opposition two fundamental components of the organism. One, energy, originating solely in the body, and the other, psychic structure, originating in, or at least constituting, the functions of the mind. Second, Also like Descartes, Freud defined these two components in vastly different terms, so that their differences were guaranteed to establish an almost unbridgeable gulf between the two. And third, precisely because of his assumption of a dualistic division of labor between the two, Freud defined one component as active and energized but directionless, while he relegated the other, much as Descartes did, to the passivity and powerlessness of a merely perceptual and surface entity. Collectively, these three characteristics created for Freud, as for Descartes, a theory that was far too abstract and disconnected from the experiential phenomena he was trying to explain. What, after all, Fairbairn would ultimately ask, can be meant by a psychic structure that has no energy? It is a concept that is so foreign to the phenomenological experience of ourselves that it is almost impossible to grasp. Indeed, it was to these characteristics of Freud's theory that Fairbairn reacted most strongly. And it was in the context of Fairbairn's concerns about dualism that he advanced some of his most penetrating arguments against Freud's instinct theory. Fairbairn argued, for instance, that Freud's theory is internally inconsistent, since it posits conflict between ego and instinct, while at the same time depriving ego of energy with which to enter into that conflict. And he pointed out that Freud's dualism had been outdated by modern physics. Which sees energy and matter as interrelated and interchangeable. Under this view, energy without form or direction cannot exist, and any theory that separates them, like Freud's, renders both concepts meaningless. But the most telling criticisms that Fairbairn advanced all carry an appeal to observed data about how we actually live in relationships with others. Asserting, for example, that all evidence suggests that humans are by nature social animals, Fairbairn argued that Freud's theory led to the misguided conclusion that objects are significant only insofar as they provide a means for forwarding the pleasure-seeking aim. Framing this argument slightly differently, Fairbairn said that Freud's decision to separate energy from the structures that would give it meaning and direction entailed a psychological hedonism that relegates object relationships to a secondary place. Finally, Fairbairn asserted that depriving an instinct of the immediacy of knowing what object will satisfy it ultimately consigns the individual to a prison, remember Descartes' homunculus, a prison of isolation and solipsism, where the primary determinants of experience, the instincts, are too divorced, not only from the rest of the mind, but also from the interpersonal world as we all live it. The picture Freud's theory paints, Fairbairn suggested, is of an individual who does not know and must discover via convoluted mechanisms of induction that this object, i.e. a mother, and not that object, say a toaster, will satisfy his or her most fundamental needs. For Fairbairn, such an individual cannot exist and must be regarded as the figment of the imagination of a dualistic theory that is straining too hard to impose its ideological presuppositions on the actual contours of human experience. Now, I think I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to talk about Fairbairn's alternative. Suffice it to say that Fairbairn described a self that was none of these things, that was not divided within itself, but instead holistic and integrated, and it contained dynamic structures that themselves possessed both object and drive wrapped up together so that they could not be divided. I think Fairbairn, I doubt that he read von Schirnhaus, but he continued the spirit of von Schirnhaus in saying, let's make our theories a little closer to human nature, as it actually is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, do we have 5 minutes?
Okay, we have 5 minutes for questions and comments.
If I'm asking a lot of questions, it's because I'm enjoying this so much. Thank you very much indeed. The question I want to ask, it relates back to Fairbairn's biography, in fact, and his critique of Freud's dualism, and his, which came out obviously of his turn to psychoanalysis, was in his lifetime associated with his experience during the First World War and his engagement with shell shock, people suffering shell shock. And I wonder if there is any evidence around how much his own experience picking up on Schoenhaus actually then, his is not a philosophical critique from the beginning, but is it not absolutely grounded in his own direct experience with patients, his observations about other people also, realizing that Freud's drive theory is actually not speaking to the distress that these people were encountering as a result of shell shock. I don't think that's very eloquent, but I think you get my drift.
I don't know if there's any evidence of that and helping formulate this critique of dualism. What I could say is that Fairbairn was interested in dualism from the beginning of his philosophic training, and his focus on Aristotle, actually, in his studies of Hellenic philosophy, was largely because of Aristotle's criticism of Platonic. So I think there's probably a dialect that if Fairbairn had those ideas in mind and then had these experiences that convinced him that living trauma, or actually just living a life, you simply cannot see the kinds of separation
Hello. Ooh. My name is Carlos Rodriguez. I came from Madrid. I want to thank you for your clear exposition, very informative and very deep. And I have only one question. Would you mind to try to tell us in which measure you think that the current explanations of the relationship between the brain and the behavior done by the present investigators, as I am thinking about Damasio, for example, repeat some of these difficulties made by Descartes. You told about you used a word for me very very interesting is the contortions. Why do you think they are making today the same contortions?
We only have 1 minute.
In 1 minute.
I do think that neuroscience always sort of walks an edge, it teeters on an edge of falling into a reductionism where they reduce mind to just body, which really is the elimination of mind. Right? What we have to do is keep in mind a dialectic, something just like the idea yesterday of a multimodal theory, we have to recognize that both are actually symbolic systems by which we address what I think ultimately is the unitary phenomenon. I don't think our language actually helps us very much. I think language forces us to divide things down the middle, on one side or another. And I think neuroscience can sometimes fall into that trap. I don't know Damasio's work that well, but I know there are some neuroscientists that are actually quite sensitive to this issue. There's a philosopher in California who wrote a book called Neurophilosophy that speaks about this issue quite a bit.
Thank you very much, Dr. Polton, for such an enriching presentation. Thank you. And for the last presentation of this session is Dr. Gal Gerson. Dr. Gerson is a doctor in philosophy, a senior lecturer, University of Haifa School of Political Sciences, Publications and the History of Liberalism, Gender in Political Theory, and the Interface Between Political Thought and Psychoanalytic Theory. Dr. Gerson will be speaking about Hegelian themes in Fairbairn's work, and he will have 20 minutes for his presentation and 5 minutes for discussion. Thank you very much.
Ivan, I used the other microphone. I think you need to turn
it.
The one that was on the table.
Oh, okay, hold on.
So I think you're...
Okay, talk again.
Yeah. Is it okay now?
No. Not very well. Talk again.
Now? One, two, three, nothing? Okay. Can you actually hear me speaking
is
without the mic?
Hold on, no, hold on. Is the microphone actually on?
Ah, good point.
Yeah, the on switch is
it wasn't on.
Just open the doors at the side.
Okay. Right. Is it okay now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, as you might have gathered from Dr. Sitton's introduction of me, I'm not really a psychologist or a clinician or a therapist of any description. What I am basically is an historian of political thought, which is not really a profession, but academia tolerates all sorts of things, and this happens to be one of them. Around a decade ago, I wrote a couple of articles in which I tried very, very hard to force march two separate sets of ideas into one another and making them one. One was the object relation psychoanalysis as it appeared in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and the other one was the philosophy of the British welfare state as it was formulated since the beginning of the 20th century. My basic point was that on both ends of the equation, what you could see is that politics, the affairs of the state, the running of huge bureaucracies, the management of the entire society, these pursuits were not understood by either object relations analysts or welfare state theorists as something which is special. Politics was not unique. It's not something which is done outside by specialized agents who are dealing in intrigue and internal combinations and are trying to move huge armies. The state is something which is familiar. Politics is something which happens all the time and which is basically a continuation of our very first experiences. If you just think about the kind of catchphrases which attached to the welfare state, it is supposed to be a kind of a government that ensures the citizens from the cradle to the grave. So the state is not, the government is not some kind of external power, it's not some kind of clerk behind a stand who's taking forms for, who's handing out forms to, for you to sign. The state that ensures the citizen from the cradle to the grave is a guide. It's a benevolent entity that guides the citizen throughout the life cycle from infancy to childhood to adult life and later on to old age and death. Which is why in some quarters that the welfare, the idea of a welfare state was ridiculed as a nanny state, which is the expression nanny state actually betrays the internal logic of in the entire welfare state thinking. The government was seen in a way as a kind of a meta parent, a kind of a parent writ large. And that is because what the state does, what government does, is not something specialized. It is a continuation of the basic care that goes on in the home. And there are countless treatises from the beginning of the 20th century onwards in which sociologists, publicists, social philosophers, journalists actually lay out these ideas and formulate them. And many of these ideas actually went on and became embedded in the structures of social democracy as they developed towards the middle of the 20th century. Now, in object relation psychoanalysis, there is this idea that the mother is able to induce in the child a simultaneous acknowledgement of the mother as a separate person and of the mother as a trustworthy person. Think about Winnicott's idea of what he calls the maternal failure. The mother goes away, then she comes back. So she is a separate person, but she's a person that we can trust. And because we can trust the mother, we can trust other people as well. There are tracts in Donald Winnicott, also in Ian Sutty, in which the phrase or phrases which are similar to it appear. The entire society comes in to occupy and populate the space created by the mother. What kind of society would that be? It would be a society in which people recognize and acknowledge each other as separate human beings who have their own interests, who have their own values, who have their own perspectives. But at the same time, the fact that the other is another, the fact of alterity, is not threatening, it's not menacing, it doesn't cause any threat or ambiguity. It is welcome. It is actually the basis of creativity. Because we are different, we bring different ideas to the conversation, and because we bring different ideas to the conversation, our conversation is productive. And this is something which happens first between the mother and the child, but then expands on from those first intimate spaces to occupy the entire run of society, of civilization. It would be a peaceful civilization because it will be a civilization in which people respect each other while at the same time acknowledging each other's separateness. While I was writing this, I had this creeping, uncomfortable feelings that things were not, well, they were not right. Because while this kind of description of a match between welfare state thought on the one hand and object relations psychoanalysis on the other, while it worked, and it worked quite well, I think, for John Bowlby and for Winnicott, in a sense for Ian Sutty, probably also for the second generation, for Mary Ainsworth and Masood Khan and the other, Ronald Fairbairn stood out. He did not stand out blatantly. He was obviously part of this group. He shared some of its ideas, actually formulated some of their ideas. But in some ways, it began to dawn on me that his social and even political and ideological ideas were a little bit different. And I think that this has a lot to do with his affiliation to the Prussian idealist, Georg Hegel. Georg Hegel, as you know, wrote mainly at the beginning of the 19th century to brutally oversimplify what he's saying. I would try to condense it. What Hegel is saying is that we don't have direct access to the world because our senses have to go through the mind. How do we even know we exist? We know that we exist because we meet another person, but how do we know that the other person exists? We know that the other person exists because the other person resists us. If I apply pressure to this stand, it will topple over and fall. If I apply pressure to another person, that person will just push back. So it's the fact of resistance that tells us that the other person exists. So if without going now into all the details, the very idea, if this is the core idea of Hegel's notion of how society works, One of the things that it means is that all social relationships are fraught with tension. They would not exist without the tension. Society is shot through with incipient discomfort about the existence of the other. This cannot be wished away. This also registers in Hegel's idea of how society is actually layered, how the different organizational units are placed one on top of the other. If the other exists as a separate person, then to relate to the other, I have to acknowledge his separateness. How do I do this? How do I acknowledge the fact that the other person has a different perspective, a different set of interests than I do? I do this by sacrificing something, giving that person something which I didn't really want to give. I think in the smallest units, in families, this is actually the stuff of romantic comedies. A person wants to meet a person of the opposite sex for romantic and sexual purposes. He actually wants the gratification of his own bodily urges. But to maintain the relationship, you have to give something. You have to listen to what the other person says. You have to give him or her time. You have to bring flowers on an anniversary day. You have to watch TV together. You have to give something. And the same thing happens again and again and again. Each level has to give something to the level above it. The individual has to give something to the family, as we just said. The family has to give something to the surrounding community. And the surrounding community has to give something to the final level of our organization, which for Hegel is the state. Now, why this is, it's because the state is characterized by the fact that it has a monopoly on lethal violence. It's the only agent that can legally and legitimately kill us. If somebody else kills us, it's a criminal or crime organization, but the state can legitimately kill us. So citizenship, which is the registry, the writing down of the fact that I am acknowledged, I'm recognized by the state. Recognition by the state involves recognition of the state. I have to acknowledge that the state is what it is. But what is it? It's a monopoly on violence. It's something that can kill me. So what I have to give to the state is not a presents or time or money or flowers on anniversary day. What I have to give to the state is my life. It doesn't mean that it actually has to kill me, but I have to be ready to lay down my life for the state. This is how it's defined. This is how civic a union is defined. Which brings Hegel to a kind of a paradox, because all the lower level of social organization are about life. The state is about death, it's about killing people, it's about wars, it's about coercion, about prison, and etc. But all the lower social units, they're about life. The family is life-giving, it's about birth, it's about cherishing children. How can the two actually coexist? Hegel's answer is the trope of Antigone. He uses the Sophoclean play about Antigone. You know that Antigone, the Theban princess, she has a brother who is a renegade. He fights against his own country. So she is not allowed, the state does not allow Antigone to bury her brother. She buries him nonetheless because she's moved by deep feelings of kinship. And for that, she is punished by being locked alive in a cave. This is not actually how the play goes. This is how Hegel reads it. For him, this illustrates how the state and family relationship should actually be structured. The family is not deleted by the state. It's not being crushed by the state. It's not denied by the state. But it's being put. The state subsumes the family under its own structures. We all have those parts in which we're attached to other people, emotionally or romantically or sexually or whatever, but when we go out to the street, we go out to the open, we have to abide by the cold, impersonal laws of the state. Antigone, the family, is buried under the state. The connection between Fairbairn and Hegel is not my own. It's in my own discovery. It has been remarked on before. I want to show how this actually works with Hegel. First of all, in in Fairbairn, recognition is the basic motivation. This is again like Hegel. We have this internal chatter of the split up objects and their correlating egos. Yeah, because the first attachment, the first holding is always unsatisfactory. Therefore, we develop all this arsenal of part egos and part objects, and we have this internal chatter which constitutes our internal life. For Fairbairn, therapy is not about just listening to that internal conversation. It's about overcoming it. Overcoming it means growing from intimacy to and the ability to interact impersonally with other people. For Fairbairn, and he says so explicitly, it means the ability to interact with people who cannot be subsumed, who cannot be related to the early attachment figures. It means the ability to relate to people in circumstances which are demanding, which are impersonal, which are even dangerous. And this is finally and ultimately, this ultimately plays out in wartime. And the only agent that can actually carry this out is the state. Now, for Fairbairn, as for Hegel, and again, this is explicit in Fairbairn, both the state and the family are not reducible to each other. We need the family because we need to grow up somewhere, and we need the state because this registers the ultimate capacity of the healthy individual. For Fairbairn, this leads him to reject both the poles of utopia and totalitarianism. Utopia is a wishing away of tension. It's like Marxism, the kind of society in which everybody gives what he has and gets back what he likes to get back. This is a wishing away of all tension, of all healthy recognition. On the other hand, Fairbairn also rejects military rule, totalitarianism, and fascism for this same reason. It does away with the state-family division. What totalitarian rule does is it makes us inform on our parents and our spouses. And ultimately, Fairbairn says this explicitly, the totalitarian dictator puts himself up as a kind of a family figure. He's the father of the nation, or big brother in George Orwell's parody of totalitarianism. So what this does is to do away with the separation which for Fairbairn consists and actually embodies the kind of personality which he thinks is healthy. The upshot of all this is that for Fairbairn, unlike what we find in Winnicott or Satie or John Bowlby, for Fairbairn, the state is a demanding agent. It's not a nanny. It's not something which is an extension of the mother. We only become healthy. We only become mature adults who recognize our own place in society if we are able to take place, to take part in an interaction which is truly public and political, detached from all the from the pool of the earliest relationship, from the pool of intimacy and the caring relationship. All this does not expel him, of course, from the object relations school, but it does politically put him a little at a distance from them. I guess that one of the reasons is the kind of Hegelian influence that actually registers in his work. And that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gerson. I think it's a very broadening perspective, extremely interesting. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We have 5 minutes.
My name is Olaf from Norway. I would like to pick up your last point, which made me think about Lacan. Yeah. And the name of the father, and if you can see some relevancy between Lacan
thank you for this question. I'm afraid that I cannot answer it in full because I don't really understand what Lacan is saying. Basically. okay, I, it, okay, I, I know there is a correspondence which is well known, not correspondence in letters, but they run parallel between Winnicott and Lacan, because they both relate to something which is called the mirror stage. So if you want to find Lacanian echoes in British object relations theory, I guess that the place would probably be in Winnicott. I think that they were also quite aware of each other's work, but I'm not totally sure about it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Excuse me, I'm Carlos again. Well, thank you very much for your brilliant presentation. And I want only to ask a little question. You told us that the origin of the Fairbank theory, the origin is the recognition, to be recognized by the other. And, well, I understand that. I agree. But for me, that the main sentence, the main principle by Fairbairn is to be with the object. For me, it's not a question of recognition. Winnicott talked something about the recognition, taking the Lacan mirror, the Lacan la regard de l'objet. For me, Fairbairn is the boy for the little boy for Fairbairn is looking the contact. It's not a question of the vision; it's a contact of the skin.
You think about it in primarily tactile, physical terms of contact. Is this what you're suggesting, that we think more about physical proximity than about recognition?
Yes.
Possibly, definitely a constructive idea. I'll have to think about it. But for me, when Fairbairn says the ego is object seeking and it seeks an object. It doesn't seek gratification. For me, this opens up the possibility of Fairbairn actually talking about something which is not merely or quintessentially tactile or physical. I guess that the notion is there. The notion of physical proximity is there in Fairbairn. I don't deny it. But so far as my reading of Fairbairn is in any way close to the mark, I think that he basically means a kind of relationship that will go on and survive regardless of any kind of physical contact. But again, thank you for this idea.
Yeah. David Scharf, I agree with you. It's a larger scope of relationship that involves many things. It's simplified into simple terms that mean so much. I experience your formulation of this as quite brilliant and enlarging my vision. But it seems to me it's an extrapolation of positions that Fairbairn took that were much closer to everyday experience. That he was certainly, and he wrote against totalitarianism and against utopianism, but it seems to me he might not himself have been fully aware of where this stood in the philosophical spectrum. What do you think?
I'm not really. First of all, thank you very much. I'm not really sure how much he was versed in the kind of literature that we teach in the introduction to political philosophy classes. But it seems to me that he knew his Hegel, I think, quite well. And surprisingly, or for me not so surprisingly, the kind of ideas, of, especially of political and social ideas that he has, fall, potentially surprisingly close to those of other Hegelian social thinkers in Britain. I think, for example, about Bernard Bosanquet or C.S. Locke, that's L-O-C-H. They actually wrote, I think, something about 40, 50 years before him, and they were a tradition. There was a tradition of British Hegelianism that ran parallel to all the tradition, all the schools that went into the making of the welfare state. They were not, the British Hegelians were not social democrats, they were not Fabians, they were not socialists, but they were not conservatives either. What they were is that they had this vision of a society in which people grow up in families, and what government is supposed to do is give families counsel, give them education, give them information about how to raise their children. This is what the therapist does in Fairbairn. He doesn't live for the patient. The patient has to live for himself. Fairbairn has this quote, which I think it's probably in the first thing I ever read in Fairbairn, is that he had this patient who said, "My life is interfering with my neurosis." And that is exactly what the British Hegelians on the social, what they wanted to prevent. They wanted to prevent a situation in which people are so much taken up by their internal in the sense of family and all the things that all the mental and the social and the economic things that hold them back, that they won't participate. So the state has to give them the education that would enable them to participate. But the state cannot live for them, so the state does not hand out benefits. The state does not hand out free services. It does hand out education and counseling services. Moreover, in British Hegelians, there is this notion of disenfranchisement. Unless you can show that you are a responsible householder, you don't get to vote. Because voting is about responsible people.
I wish we had more time. But we don't. Thank you so much. Thank you.